explore and picnic in the gardens before the show. Further information available at www.seatricum.com and at kpfk.org.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. More Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week, but layoffs are still rare and jobless claims remain at historically low levels. The Labor Department reported filings for benefits ticked up to 206,000 last week from a revised 204,000 the week before. The four-week average of claims, which smooths out week-to-week volatility, rose modestly to 207,250. Claims for jobless benefits are a proxy for layoffs, and economists watch them because they can be a sign of where the job market is headed. For the past year, claims have mostly stayed within a historically low range of 200,000 to 230,000 a week. But employers aren't eager to take on new workers. The Labor Department reported Tuesday that gross hiring, before subtracting people who lost or left their jobs, fell 5% to fewer than 5.1 million new jobs. A federal judge in Maryland has blocked President Trump's latest attempt to ban birthright citizenship. Judge Deborah Boardman granted a preliminary injunction on Wednesday, stopping Trump's executive order until a class action lawsuit by immigrant families and advocacy groups is resolved. Birthright citizenship is guaranteed under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Trump's order aimed to restrict citizenship for children born to certain foreign nationals. The judge said the U.S. Supreme Court already ruled on the issue in June, finding that children in the class action case are citizens at birth. Boardman said Trump's new executive order, issued in August, violated the high court's earlier ruling. Feminist icon Gloria Steinem has died. She was 92. The former journalist and author co-founded Ms. Magazine and was a leading voice of the American women's movement in the 1960s and 70s. Steinem spoke out for gender equality on the page and on frequent television and radio interviews and in college campus tours and rallies. At a rally in New York in 2019, Steinem said today's feminist leaders can learn from the leaders of the past.
Feminists too often believe that no one has ever experienced the kind of society that empowered women and made that empowerment the basis of rules and civilization. The price the feminist community must pay because it is unaware is confusion, division, and much lost time.
Steinem's death was announced on social media on Wednesday. She died at her New York City home. She began her career as a journalist, notably one who reported in 1963 on degrading conditions in Hugh Hefner's Playboy Empire, an undercover assignment that she later came to regret. She credits a meeting 6 years later where women spoke out boldly in favor of abortion rights with changing her career path. She remained active, traveling, speaking, and writing well into her 80s. Iran has launched attacks on U.S. Gulf allies. Iranian forces fired drones at Kuwait and Bahrain after U.S. strikes in Iran. Iranian state media said a U.S. strike hit a wedding party, killing 5 people and wounding 68. Bahrain intercepted several Iranian attacks on Wednesday. Kuwait reported a fire caused by an Iranian drone and said it was attacked again today. Meanwhile, a Saudi shipping company says 2 sailors died in an attack in the Strait of Hormuz on Monday. Iran has tightened control over the strait, affecting global oil trade. Pakistan continues mediation efforts between the U.S. and Iran. An EPA plan could make it harder for the public to learn about and comment on proposed AI data centers. The proposal has sparked a backlash in communities across the country and become a key election issue. It would eliminate a federal requirement that states notify the public and seek comment before issuing air pollution permits for data centers and other industrial sites. States could still invite public comment, but that would no longer be required as a condition to grant permits. Critics say that could prevent residents from learning about proposed data centers and weighing in before projects are approved and construction begins. Those are the Pacifica headlines. I'm Max Pringle.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we talk election protection with leading movement attorney and strategist Judith Brown Dianis, and we discuss the tragic suicide of Pierre Damas Bell, Haitian deportations, and the ways that we support our Haitian neighbors with longtime advocate and organizer Pierre Labasserie. All this and more on Sojourner Truth. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. As we head into the final stretch before the 2026 midterm elections, concerns over the integrity of those elections continue to grow. There is even a petition calling on international bodies to provide monitors to make sure these elections are free and fair. Community groups, organizations, and civil and human rights attorneys from across the United States have been meeting and moving locally, statewide, and nationally to protect voters and our votes in the face of the administration's continued attacks against its own citizens' voting rights. Pleased to be joined by an expert in this area to talk us through a few of the most possible scenarios voters should be prepared to face as we move into these midterm elections, with some helpful hints we need to share. Judith Brown Dianis is my guest, and she is a longtime movement attorney, strategist, working in this area of election protections. So pleased to be joined by her now. Greetings, Judith. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
So we are looking, we're in the fever pitch. Fever pitch, comrade, folks. Primaries have happened. Some primaries just happened. Folks are looking forward to November. And we're hearing more and more about this thing called election protection. And I think people kind of guess from the name that it's not trying to destroy elections, but I'm not sure that people have a sense of what election protection may include. So let's start with that, just so we're on the same level set in terms of what we're talking about when we're talking about election protection.
Sure. election protection is basically what we're trying to do through election protection. I actually refer to it as voter protection because I like to protect voters, not necessarily elections, and make sure that their votes count. And that's part of the work, is stopping the things that can happen to prevent votes from people being able to cast votes and from election officials trying to have them not counted for many reasons. And so the thing that people need to know is that when we talk about election protection and voter protection, the work is not just like on election day, right? Because there are decisions that are made by local election officials and secretaries of state every day that can prevent or, you know, cut off voting opportunities and execute voter suppression activities. So it's not just election day, right? It's all the decisions that get made about where polling places are going to be, what's open, what's going to be closed, when early voting is, how many days you're going to have early voting, are you going to have voting on Sunday or not, right? So there's those decisions that are made by election officials, and then election protection and voter protection also include making sure people are protected from outside forces that might show up at the polling places, right? And then it goes into making sure that people actually, that their ballots are counted and that they are allowed to go into a polling place, cast it, have it counted, whether that's by provisional or regular ballot. So it's a stream of things that happen along throughout the election cycle that is the work of making sure that people are protected when they go to vote and that their vote is ultimately counted.
I love the reframe of voter protections, because at the end of the day, that is what make elections. It's the voters. No voters, nothing is happening. That's a lot of how the manipulation happens. In this time period, there's a lot of concern about whether or not, you know, elections even happen, or what is going to happen to voters, what is going to happen to people's votes. I want to take advantage of the opportunity that I'm getting to talk to you here to go through a couple of scenarios, maybe three or four, that we can think about and how those impact voters and our capacity to protect the, you know, them physically, as well as the votes that folks are casting, and sort of where in that process people might be able to intervene. So I want to start with the polling places piece. And I'm thinking about that here in California, we used to have polling places. So I had a place that I went to all the time. And then they moved that place. And the consternation, I'm not talking about Mississippi, I'm talking about California, the consternation that that caused actually pushed us to now have a system in LA County of voting centers. So now you can vote anywhere in LA County. You don't have to have a particular polling place because, you know, Black folks were getting messed up left and right with the changing of the polling stations or polling places. So talk to us about that as a tactic that we already see and already have seen them use in order to snatch people's votes or voting power.
Sure. So, I mean, this is like one of those things that seems like it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal, right? Because what we see is in the highly contested elections is where, this is where the shenanigans start to happen, right? So people will show up to a polling place where they have voted for 20, 30 years, and all of a sudden that polling place has been closed and moved someplace else, right? It could be those small closures, or it could be in like a place like Tarrant County, Texas, where the election officials put forth a proposal to remove 92 polling sites before the November election, right? Or it could be what happened in North Carolina, where they moved the polling place off of the campus of the historically Black college, North Carolina A&T, right? Those decisions about where polling places are are intentional decisions, right? You would think that what you would do is that you would put polling places to make it convenient for people. But here, where you have these folks who are trying to rig the election, what they do is that they will close polling places to make it inconvenient for voters, with the idea that, one, when you get closer to election and you have moved a polling place, that creates chaos. Because now people go to the wrong polling location. Even if they got a mailer, they may not have paid attention to that mailer, right? They changed it. But they will go to that polling place where they voted for 20 years and no longer will it be there. The question is, will they make the extra effort to then get back in the car and go someplace else, right? Or if you've closed 92 polling places, it means that you're going to have long lines at the places that are left. And the question there is, are voters going to stand in line? People have to pick up their kids. I got to go to work, all those kinds of things, right? And so that creates an inconvenience that stands in the way of your right to vote. And this is a calculated decision that is being made, because you actually know that the more polling places you have, the more convenient it is for people. And so if you don't want people to vote, then you reduce those opportunities.
There are lots of folks that are frightened, right? People got into mail-in voting, mail-in ballots and being able to do that. And now people are afraid that they're going to put it in the mail and it's never going to make it there. And so, right. You know, what should people be thinking about there? What kinds of things can we do? And should we, around the protection of mail-in ballots?
Right. Well, this is another one of those things where what Trump has done is he has thrown the election system into chaos, right? By this whole idea of, you know, coming down on mail-in voting. So what has happened is that he has wanted to make a list that is a national list of voters. People should know that actually the federal government does not get to control who gets to vote and when we get to vote, how we vote. The states make those decisions. He has stepped in to try and make his own list of who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote. So, and he's done that by using the Postal Service and basically saying, if your name ain't on our list, then the Postal Service is not going to send you a mail-in ballot. That's the controversy that is in court. This is the thing, is like things keep, the chaos is because the courts keep going back and forth on this. And in fact, the last decision, I believe, you know, you got to check it every hour, was that they could not move forward with this. But there's a whistleblower who has said they're still moving forward with this plan, despite the court's orders that said that you can't do this right now. So my suggestion to voters is that if you're going to vote by mail-in ballot, there's a couple of things you can do. One is get your mail-in ballot and vote early. Do not wait around. Don't get around that deadline, et cetera, and worry about it. Get your vote in. The other thing you can do is if you're voted by mail-in ballot, you could also, in most states, you can take your ballot into the polling location and hand it to the people at the polling location. So then you don't have to stand in line, whatever. But those are two things that you could be doing to avoid these kinds of problems. But again, we need to understand that these attacks on how we vote are really about trying to shave off the numbers of voters, right? They want to rig the system so we can vote. So what we have to do is we have to overwhelm the system by all of us going out to vote, right? So that there's no question about which way the elections go.
Absolutely. Follow Black people as usual. Black math breaks maps. Black math breaks all the stuff, right? Get out there and vote. Let's talk about voting in person, because there is a lot of concern that people have about intimidation at the polls. That intimidation could look like the body snatchers, right? It could look like ICE. That intimidation could look like local police. That intimidation could look like, you know, masked and unmasked mercenaries. And, you know, but that's real concerns that people have. And if someone goes, you know, to vote, and they find that there are such people around intimidating folks, what do folks do?
Yeah. So first, people should know that you should be able to vote free from intimidation. And in most states, they have these kind of a perimeter of space in which people can't come within, like in most states, it's like 100 feet from the door of a polling place. So that doesn't mean that they won't be there, right? Doesn't mean the Proud Boys won't show up. Doesn't mean that ICE won't show up, right? And so what you can be doing as a voter is, first of all, know that, you know, you have that right to go in there and vote. Two is, if you feel intimidated, you can report it to someone working at the polling place, the judge at the polling place, or one of the poll workers. The other thing you can do is, there is a hotline that people should call into that is connected to people who will be out in the field, you know, at polling places in many of the states, and is connected to lawyers. And it's 1-866 Our Vote, OURVOTE. And so that's an important number to keep. That's the Election Protection Hotline. There are people online to help you, et cetera. So again, like, let's not be intimidated by these people. Let's go in and vote. You know, this is the reason that they are doing this, right? Is because they want to consolidate power against us, right? It shows how important the vote is that we get into these election cycles and some people try and do everything they can to keep us from voting. So let us not let them have the power over us.
Thinking about one another piece that actually hadn't talked about, what is when people are finding out when they get to the polls that they allegedly aren't eligible to vote, that mm-hmm. somehow they've been purged from the polls, they're off the polls, they, you know, they're not on the list, etc. What can folks do to protect themselves ahead of time? And yeah. I know every state is different, but what are the kinds of things people can do in the moment when you actually just right. want to punch someone in the face, but you can't punch them in the face? That's not going to help you get the vote.
Right. Okay. So pre-election, I want people to check their voter registration. You can go online, usually with your state secretary of that is your secretary of state, and check your voter registration. Make sure your address is correct, right? Make sure your name is correct. And that's, you know, you should be able to check where you go to vote. If you can't check it at the state level, you can check it at your county level, your county board of elections. Check that early. Update, please update your stuff, right? If you're not registered, most states it's by October 5th, which is a month out from the election. If you're not registered, get registered, right? If you have moved, make sure that you update your address so that you can figure out where you're going to vote. And make a plan to vote. You know, make a plan. Like, when am I going to do this? There's early voting days. Many states have Sundays, et cetera. Go vote early. You don't have to wait until the Tuesday in most places. So make sure that you know the rules. Again, check on your Secretary of State website and you can find that out. And then also, if you get to the polling place and your name is not on the rolls, what you are going to want to do, or if they say that there's a problem, you always have the right to vote by provisional ballot. Provisional ballot, we have it because we had elections like the 2000 election where people showed up and their names weren't on it. So now we have provisional ballots where they take them and they check to make sure after the election whether or not you actually were able to vote, and then they will count it. But if you vote provisional, you need to follow up. Make sure that you've provided all the information within, it's usually 3 to 5 days, most states 3 days, that you have a period of time to give them whatever missing information there was. So, you know, unfortunately, we got to do a little bit of work, right? I mean, for this right to vote, but it is a sacred right. And again, we can't let them have the power over us and take our voice from us. Right. And, no, I was just going to say, a lot of states people get kind of, we take it for granted, Right. I live in Maryland. Take it for granted. Like, no, you know, like our state is handling their business with regard to voting. But that is not the case for every place. And if this administration has anything to do with it, they'd be messing up places like Maryland and California also by interfering with our elections.
You know, I'm ready for them because we don't even have voter ID out here. So they ready. They coming and they ready. Before I let you go, I want to talk about a scenario that, you know, is sort of the after vote scenario, because there is all of this conversation around what happens if the votes are stolen, if the elections are stolen, what happens if, you know, people are not allowed to vote, if the Proud Boys or ICE show up, which almost are the same thing, like in that Spider-Man universe, what happens if all of that occurs? But what happens if people get elected and then they don't get seated? What can happen there, both kind of organizationally, legally? And I ask because obviously the work that you have done as a movement attorney is always connected to the people. It's never been just like out here in the universe being a movement attorney. Yeah. No. It's been connected to the people, and they may look up and say, we don't care, Justin Pearson, that you won. We ain't giving you a seat. Now what mm-hmm. happens?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, so I think there's a few things. One is that, of course, there will be 5 million lawsuits, right? Like the candidates will sue, the parties will sue. So there'll be a lot of court activity if that happens, right? Because, again, the president doesn't have the right to step in and decide who gets seated in Congress, right? There's a whole process about how this happens, right? But this president doesn't care anything about process. So I want to be clear about that, right? Two is, look, while the lawyers are on court, we better be in the streets. We best be in the streets, okay. Right? Because we cannot sit back and let this consolidation of power, the takeover of our government, that would be like a coup happening. And so we got to decide whether or not we're going to save this democracy, right? And we're going to stand up for what is right and for our voices and for the people that we elected to represent us, to have our voice in Congress, right? Or if we just go sit around and watch, you know, keep watching TV and act like ain't nothing happening. So get activated. You know, get activated in your state. That doesn't mean you got to come to Washington, D.C. I suspect if they're not seating people in Congress, we're going to be in the streets everywhere across the country. And so I really hope that people will take this very seriously, because this is a potential thing that could happen, because we know how desperate they are to consolidate power. And it is something that if we let it happen, things are going to get worse. It's going to get dire. And we will not. And remember, this is a president who said that we don't need to have elections any longer. So get ready for this. Get activated. Figure out where your political home is so that you can join in what the heat that will be in the streets if something like that happens.
Absolutely. And know that we can do something, because even in some of these other countries that some of us come from, they try to have a coup. The people say, I think not. We're going to uncoup this coup. That's against military might. So there's nothing to fear. We just have to move forward. Our courage will be in community. Thank you so very much, Judith. Really, really appreciate you.
Thank you.
You know, we're gonna have to play this over and over as we get closer so people can remember. Right. And have this in their pocket, because it's that critical. Really appreciate you and all the work that you have done and continue to do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. And that was movement attorney, strategist, election and voter protection extraordinaire, Judith Brown Dianis, about voter protection and how we maintain the integrity of these midterm elections and beyond. More Sojourner Truth with Pierre Labasserie after this short break.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
bed I hear the clock tick, and I think of you, caught up in circles, confusion is nothing new. Flashback, warm nights, almost left behind. Suitcase of memories, time after sometimes you picture me. I'm walking too far ahead, you're calling to me, and I can't hear a word you say. Didn't you say, go slow?
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Over the past week, the United States has deported hundreds of Haitians back to Haiti. These deportations were not the first of the year, but certainly they were the first well-publicized since the Supreme Court's decision allowing the revocation of temporary protected status from Haitians living in the United States. Just this past Monday, a 20-year-old young Haitian man, Pierre Damas Bell, walked into traffic, resulting in his death after losing that protected status and being forced to wear an ankle shackle. In the past week, also, over 47 people were massacred in Haiti, with that government continuing to claim that, along with the United States, the country is ready to receive people being deported there. Pierre Labasserie is a co-founder of the Haitian Action Committee and the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. Greetings, Pierre. How are you, my brother?
Well, doing well, my sister. Now that I'm on your show, it's always a pleasure to be with you. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I know that it has been It's been a tough year, a tough 2 years, but
indeed,
focusing on the past couple of weeks, thinking about front of my mind is both the death of Pierre Damas Bell and also thinking about the massacre in Haiti and really, wondering how our Haitian siblings, how we ourselves are able to move forward, still with a light and a feeling of hope. But let's talk first about our young brother, Pierre Damas Bell, who we understand, according to his family, according to reports, walked into traffic and was killed and intentionally walked into traffic. There are understanding, we know that this was a brother who was a former TPS holder from Haiti, that he was just started college, gone to college on a scholarship, that he, was ROTC, that he had just applied for asylum and, in fact, had his first hearing coming up in October, that he, went to church and did all the things that people tell you that you're supposed to do. Played football, also known as soccer in this country, was loved by his family, loved by his friends, all of the things. And yet, the toll of what this regime brought to his doorstep, brought to his person, was too heavy. Talk to us about our brother Pierre, how it has impacted the community and anything that you know about what's going on in this situation.
Yeah, indeed. And to start off, I want to say condolences to the family, father, mother, siblings, all the relatives of Pierre Damas Bell, and also the friends and the community. This news, this very, very tragic news, has hit the Haitian community, the Haitian diaspora, let me put it that way. Everywhere you see social media, people are just crying, really, over social media. And it's people are distraught. In Haiti itself, the news has spread like wildfire, and it has greatly impacted everyone, because people feel as if, I never knew him, but to see such a young man with so much promise, and I have a son, you know, he's a little older, but I could be his daddy, you know? And so many people can relate to this young man who did everything and just described, rising star. He wanted to be a doctor, apparently very dedicated. He loved to play soccer. And that was one of the things that somebody described as a shackle. He said, let's not call it a bracelet. Let's call it what it is. It's a shackle to have that. And that prevented him from playing soccer. And then the humiliation and the ridicule of some people who were supposedly in school with him, according to the reports. Because you always, even though most people may be supportive, but you always have the few who will attack you and what have you. And also the whole idea of shackles for people who are not involved in any kind of criminal activity or anything like that, it harkens back, especially to all Black people, not just Haitians, back to the days of slavery, especially if it's something that's done to you unjustly, you know? And people, and we saw images of Haitian grown men and women just falling apart, crying their eyes out, and to be it's really devastating. It's a very, very tough, hard blow to all of us. And I've been receiving, not only Haitians, but I've been receiving a lot of messages from friends, people who are not from Haiti, various people who are expressing their condolences and their sympathies to me and to the people of Haiti, because people feel it deeply, what has that great, grave injustice that was done to this young man and his family and caused him to be so desperate and so despairing that he, according to the media, that he took that he ended his life so prematurely. This young man could have been a brilliant surgeon. And from what I heard, he was very interested in that field. And he could have been a brilliant saving lives. And here, over a racist policy, and caused him to do this. So this is very heart-wrenching.
It is very heart-wrenching. I mean, I myself cried. It's very heart-wrenching, very sad. It's a couple of layers to it. You know, kids are kids. And there are people who are, you know, not nice and who don't necessarily understand the burden that these ankle shackles place. We've heard again and again about the burden of them, and even for people who have been accused of crimes, because in the criminal punishment system, they have long been putting these ankle shackles on people. And, you know, still people are human beings, right? And
exactly.
Not the kind of actions that people engage in with human beings. So sad. I want to
thank
talk.
Thank you so much for this. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to talk some about the mental health piece, because one of the things that's so easy to happen is when, you know, for our immigrant communities, but particularly Black immigrants, because we don't have a lot of options that are made available to us to stay in this country, even to get into the country, first of all, to get in, let alone to stay once we're in. When something happens, like the revocation of temporary protective status, and particularly in the way that it happens, 350,000 Haitians. Of course, there have been Cameroonians before them. We have the Ethiopians just a couple of weeks ago, the Sudanese, you know, South Sudan. I think one or the other has either happened or is about to happen coming up. You know, so many folks just in the Black immigrant space, let alone beyond the Black immigrant space. And this, what's keeping people here, what's enabling people to stay with family and stay with community. And I think there is so much of a narrative that kind of feeds into this desperation. It's like, if we lose this status, the world will end. Like, everything is going to come to a stop. How do we navigate that, Pierre? Because, yes, we want people to understand the seriousness of losing temporary protective status. We want the public to understand. We want our communities to understand. We know that it is painful. We know in many cases that it is confusing, that people's worlds have been turned upside down. But we also want our people to know that there is life after TPS and that it doesn't have to be a torturous life. How do we do this? Because I can only imagine the weight that people are feeling right now.
Yes, it's it's quite a challenge. It's quite a challenge. And just to do a little recap in terms of how people, because I did translate over the years, I've been translating for a number of sisters and brothers from Haiti who came on and who've been in this country, some with TPS, some with political asylum status and what have you, different things. And so we have to put it in perspective. So Haitians started getting TPS protected status after the earthquake of 2010. But prior to that, there was massive man-made disaster in Haiti, which was the coup d'etat against a stable government, the government of President Aristide. At the time, Haitians were going back to Haiti. See, former refugees were going back to Haiti to rebuild the country. There was none of this massacre was taking place because you had the government being in charge, was a people's government implementing a people's program. And there was security and people were coming back to Haiti. So 2004, the U.S. organized a coup against President Aristide's government. And that coup d'etat, which we call the kidnapping coup d'etat of February 29, 2004, started a process of destabilization of the country and started getting Haiti rapidly going on the road, basically to be a hellish situation. So we had the troops. It's been 22 years since the United States, French, Canadian forces before. A few months later, followed by United Nations contingent. I forgot how many countries were involved, but that was the incubator for all of this gang violence, because at that time, a lot of so-called gangs, these are not gangs, these are paramilitary death squads, were attacking the population during that period of 2004-2005, and particularly attacking women vendors. It was called the Little Machete Army, and there were others as well. And it was said to be, there is evidence that they were protected by the National Police, which at the time was, they had people who were part of the paramilitary forces that had been part of the coup, integrated the police, and a number of good officers were purged from the police. So what you have, bringing it to the present, after a 22-year occupation, during which we had cholera, various natural disasters hit, the 2010 earthquake, another earthquake in 2021, devastating, cataclysmic proportions that disrupted the economy of the country and also, you know, and the livelihood of people. So many people were fleeing Haiti, fleeing to go to the Dominican Republic, fleeing to go to various countries, the islands of the Caribbean, and the U.S. And the U.S., finally, the Obama administration, I believe, provided temporary protected status. But it was after much struggle that this happened. So to have people who finally found a place of refuge to rest and to bring their families together and to be able to send their children to school, Now, all of a sudden, during the Biden era, Haitians were enticed to come to the U.S. with on legal status. They call it going to the U.S. on a Biden visa, right?
Yeah, humanitarian parole.
Humanitarian parole.
Yeah, parole program, yes.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden, this is being yanked, you know? And everything, the CPS and everything, just suddenly. In their lives now, people are finding themselves unable to go shopping, unable to go to their jobs because their work permits have been revoked. Unable to, there have been, from what I hear, from different people I've spoken with, different kind of ICE raids taking place in their neighborhoods. And so people are really, I would say, and it's no exaggeration, a sense of terror. Some have told me going back to Haiti for them is, it's terror over there as well, because the paramilitary death squads are busy attacking the population. It's been estimated that 85% of the city of the capital city of Port-au-Prince is overrun by those paramilitary forces. They come in, they raise entire neighborhoods, they kill babies, women, men, children, they don't care, burn up schools, burn down houses, conduct the worst atrocities. And according to the, there are close to 2 million, they keep saying 1.5 million, but I've been hearing that, I've been hearing 1.5 million for the past few months now, and there are more and more attacks, not only in Port-au-Prince, but in the Artibonite as well, and in other areas of Haiti. So it's a widespread campaign of terror.
I do want to talk about the massacre in Haiti. And, you know, every time I talk with you and talk with others, I always want to make sure that people understand we're not, you know, someone called our countries, and we can't cuss online, but someone called our countries asshole countries. And we want to make sure that we are not doing that. And at the same time, as you've described, there is a history of this external actions by the United States, by Canada, by France and others on our countries that lead us to be in the position that we're in right now. And so this massacre is, you know, happens in the context of everything you've described earlier. Have you been hearing anything on the ground about this massacre? What can you share with us about what people have told you who actually were there?
Plenty. It's all over social media in Creole, and I listen to it and I talk to people on the ground. It's horrific. This mother, as an example, there is this, let me start with the journalist who gave an interview, and he said he lost 14 members of his family, 14 members of his family. One of them described how he, what saved him was the was seeing the body of his father and stepmother. And he couldn't recognize them in the dark, but he went to see about them. And when he got close, he saw there were two bodies, but they were positioned. It's as if they were shot execution style and placed together. So right away, he knew not to advance because that meant those guys were in the area. This mother, particularly, she had a C-section, and she had a 5-month-old baby. And they, when I say they, the paramilitary death squads. Now, these are people who had survived a previous massacre in the area of Kinskoff. I'm talking about Kinskoff right now. And she said they were in a church. The church had given them refuge. And so they were invaded by this group of killers who came, the paramilitary death squad named Vive Ensemble. And they came in the church and started shooting at people and killing people. The room where she was at, she said that she covered the baby with her body, then her aunt covered her. And then there was another young member of the family who provided a shield with her own body. And so they shot her aunt 7 times and killed her. And then they pulled her out and she begged them to spare her life. And her 5-month-old baby, she described how that baby was being kicked by those men with big guns. And they were trying to decide her fate. One of them was opposed to them killing her and the baby. And she managed to to, by the time then there was apparently some forces came in, they heard that there was a police armored personal carrier that was coming up, and then they started running away, you know, not to be caught in that place. But and that's how she described the whole ordeal. She thought her baby was dead, but she said, I'm not going to leave the body behind. I'm going to take my baby with me. And so she went on, and fortunately, the baby survived. But the baby is all pretty much beaten up, and so was she. So it's these are testimonials like that you hear. But the worst part of it is the fact that these survivors are very critical of the Haitian police, because they said for 2 weeks, at least 2 weeks before this massacre in Kinskov, they had warned the police that this was happening. They met with one of the local chiefs of police, the local chief, who told them, yes, we know it's coming and it will be worse than the one that you survived before. You hear that? So for 2 weeks, and they say that many of the people were killed within about, they said 5 meters, which is about, if I remember correctly, it's about 25 feet from where the policemen were. But nobody intervened to prevent this massacre, to provide protection for the population, because they had no orders. Now, this is according to the survivors. And this has enraged the Haitian population. What is this? What's going on? And those officers were trained by the occupation forces that have been in charge of Haiti for the past 22 years. So this is an outrageous situation. And to take people, to send them into a situation like that, where the government, the prime minister, they are not providing for the people who've been displaced. Many times the people are protesting. What they do, they send the police to beat them up with batons and throw tear gas to disperse. All they're asking for is food, is healthcare, is shelter. The conditions are abominable. And here you are going to send back 350,000 people to a government that claims that they can receive them. How are they going to do it? When the people who are there right now, they are not doing anything for them, not even basic protection. And what's worse, according to the journalists, is that there were about 193 police officers in that area of Kinskov. But 2 days or a few days before, half of the force was removed. Half of the force was removed. So reducing the number while there was knowledge that these guys would be attacking. They had announced they were coming to attack, and they did, which is something they normally do. When they are going to attack, they tell people that they are coming to attack. So this is what many people are saying. You are throwing people back into a burning house. This is terrible. And people need to stand up with the Haitian people and say, enough, enough of this slaughter. Enough, stop the deportations. We are organizing on the 24th through the 27th, September, days of solidarity with Haiti, and we'll be getting more information out what people can do locally in their communities, in their neighborhoods, in solidarity with the people. So I'll keep you posted on that, Nana.
Please do. And before we end our conversation in a few minutes, I'm going to give you an opportunity to let people know how to follow you, how to follow the work of the organization. But I'm also thinking about the fact that we just saw two planes that have of Haitians that have been deported to Haiti. This, I mean, they made it seem like this is the first time in 10 years that people have been deported to Haiti. They've been deporting people to Haiti. Has been the response to this the last two deportation planes? Because they really did try to act like this was something new, had everybody in all white. I don't know what that was about. But what has been the response in the community to seeing that?
Oh, very, very heart-wrenching. People are very much outraged by this. And also there is this myth out there that they are giving people $2,500, which according to many sources on the ground in Haiti, which is a lie, people barely get $60 when they land, and that's it. then it's hey, you on your own, buddy, to go. Let's say, so the only airport that's now operating in Haiti receiving folks is the, we can see that it's the, it's Cape Haitian, I'm talking international flights. Port-au-Prince, the main airport, the capital, has been shut down, supposedly because they are claiming that the paramilitary death squads are shooting at the planes. However, you have tons of U.S. military there using the airport. And so people are saying, what is going on? So there is a movement on the ground called Liberate Our Airport, you know? And so when people see folks coming back, and let me say something else here too that adds to the, that is worsening the conditions. When you have folks who are working here in the US, earning their money, they would always send money home to their folks in Haiti. Because after the earthquake, the country was never rebuilt. Conditions have been made terrible after the two earthquakes, plus all the various climatic disasters that have occurred because of hurricanes and what have you. So people are providing for their families. But now this source of income or sustenance for the families have been completely, you know, wiped out and shut off. So that is creating a lot more problems for the people in terms of survival.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We see how that could only be true in terms of just, you know, millions of dollars now at risk of not being there to be invested in families and communities back home. If folks want to learn more about the Days of Action at the end of September, if they want to learn more about the work that you and the org are doing, where do they go, Pierre?
Yes, two organizations. One of them is Haiti Action Committee. That's in our website is HaitiSolidarity.net, HaitiSolidarity.net. The other one is an organization that supports grassroots efforts in Haiti, grassroots organizations in rebuilding their communities, because people in Haiti are busy building schools, local hospitals, and they are not just sitting down and watching their country be destroyed. They rebuild, they try to rebuild, go back to their communities to rebuild. And so we, the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, support those efforts. And people can find us at HaitiEmergencyRelief.org. HaitiEmergencyRelief.org.
Thank you so much, Pierre. Really, really appreciate you. And we shall talk again soon. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you so much, Nana. I very much appreciate everything you do. Thank you for having me.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. And that was human rights defender and co-founder of the Haiti Action Committee and the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, Pierre Labasserie. And that's our show. I'd like to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth team, including our dear sister Margaret Prescott, at the same time and place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well.
You're invited to join us on Saturday, September 5th, starting at 7 a.m. We'll dive deep into the Pacifica Radio archives with a special hour on the 1949 Peekskill riots with Paul Robeson. We'll also present a classic archive from former KPFK programmer Henry Slukey with songs of the American labor movement. All that and more starting this Saturday, September 5th at 7 a.m. Please join us to celebrate Labor Day weekend 2026.
your automobile, truck, boat, motorcycle, RV, or aircraft is no longer reliable, it can still go a long way towards supporting the programs you rely on as a donation. To donate it to KPFK, call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
Pasadena Playhouse presents The Visit, a haunting, twisted, and truly grotesque comedy starring Tony Award winner Jefferson Mace and Mad Men's Melinda Page Hamilton. When the richest woman in the world returns to her struggling hometown, she's ready and willing to rescue it from ruin, on one condition. Experience The Visit at Pasadena Playhouse beginning September.